Hi, this is Outbeat Radio host Greg Moralia, and I'm excited to tell you about the KRCB Holiday Fundraiser. The gift-giving season is the perfect time to think about giving yourself the gift of public radio. Make a tax-deductible donation to KRCB tonight. This will help keep Outbeat Radio coming to you every Sunday night. And we've got some amazing thank you gifts in appreciation for your support. So show us some holiday love right now by going to norcalpublicmedia.org. Just click the donate button at the top of the page and then select donate to radio. And now, here's Outbeat Radio's Living Proof.
Outbeat Radio. Outbeat Radio. Outbeat now. Outbeat collage. Living Proof. Outbeat News. Outbeat Music.
Outbeat Radio on KRCB Windsor Santa Rosa, a program that focuses on issues by, for, and or about members of the gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender communities. You can hear Outbeat Radio every Sunday night at 8 p.m.
This is Living Proof, and we're your hosts. I'm Dr. Diana Greer, and next to me is my co-host and wife, Sheridan Gold. And before we introduce our guests, we just wanted to put a shout out to us because it's our 43rd anniversary.
Woo-hoo!
Yay, honey. It's been a journey, been a wonderful journey. So thank you, thank you, thank you. And I look forward to many, many more years.
Thanks, Di. I agree, it's been a lot of fun, but I also want to add that it's been quite a classroom too. I've learned so much from you about how to be a better person in the world. Thanks, Di.
Oh, aren't we sweet, y'all? Okay. Thanks, Cher. So let's get on to our show. Tonight in studio, we have Lynn Keller and Susan Drouse. Lynn started out with piano and flute, but in college discovered the electric bass. Now Lynn is a professional bass player. She's toured with Diana Ross and Rita Coolidge, has done numerous Broadway tours, and continues to play in the pop world as much as possible. Welcome, Lynn.
Thanks so much for having me. It's such a pleasure to be on your show.
And Susan started piano at the age of 4 and was in rock bands by the time she was in the 6th grade. Can you believe that? Jeez.
No.
After studying composing and arranging at the Grove School of Music in Los Angeles, she played in many bands, arranged and composed for lots of shows, and has been the music director for national Broadway tours such as Mamma Mia, Billy Elliot, The Book of Mormon, and Beautiful, the Carole King musical. Welcome, Susan.
Thank you so much, ladies. I'm so happy to be here.
We have lots to learn about Lynn and Susan and their musical lives. Big musical lives. But first, here's news and events with Outbeat member and our engineer, Greg Moralia.
I'd love to change the world, but I don't know what to...
This is Greg Moralia with your Outbeat Radio news for the week of December 6th, 2020. A federal judge just ruled that it's unconstitutional for transgender people to be required to show proof from a doctor that they're undergoing transition-related care in order to get a passport with the correct gender marker on it. U.S. District Court Judge Gloria Navarro wrote in her ruling that the State Department has provided no explanation, let alone any evidence, of why it is important and an interest in verifying a transgender passport applicant's gender identity, nor a cogent explanation of why the policy requiring a physician certificate increases the accuracy of issued passports. Currently, the State Department requires transgender people to show a doctor's certification that they have had appropriate clinical treatment for gender transition in order to get a new gender marker of either male or female. Oliver Bruce Morris, a transgender man who lives in Nevada, applied for a passport in 2018, but his application was flagged because the gender marker didn't match his birth certificate. The State Department sent him a letter saying that he needs to send a signed original statement on office letterhead of an attending physician with language stating that he has had an appropriate clinical treatment for transition to a new sex. Morris was receiving hormone replacement therapy under the care of a nurse practitioner at the time and had not had any gender affirmation surgery. The State Department ultimately denied his application, and he sued with the help of Nevada Legal Services. Judge Navarro determined that the requirement to show a doctor's letter violated his Fifth Amendment equal protection rights. And actor Elliot Page, formerly known as Ellen Page, just announced on Twitter this week that he is transgender, making him one of the most famous transgender men in the country. He said, "I wanted to share with you that I am trans. My pronouns are he and they, and my name is Elliot." And he added, "I feel lucky to be writing this, to be here, to have arrived at this place in my life." Page rose to stardom with the hit show in 2007, Juno, for which he got an Oscar nomination. He also appeared in two X-Men films and starred in the critically acclaimed Netflix series The Umbrella Academy as Vanya Hargreaves, a violinist with the destructive power to control sound waves. And here in California, a gay man just won the right to get a license plate that says queer. In a court case brought by the Pacific Legal Foundation, the state Supreme Court ruled that California's ban on personalized license plates that contain, quote, connotations offensive to good taste and decency, is illegal under the state's constitution's free speech protection. The California DMV originally rejected the application for the plate, saying it was considered insulting, degrading, or expressing contempt for a specific group or person. But District Judge John Tegar rejected the reasoning, saying that the state government can't discriminate based on the content of speech. And last Monday was World AIDS Day. This year's theme is resilience and impact. Be sure to join us on December 27th for Outbeat News in Depth to learn more about the current status of the fight to end HIV. For Outbeat Radio News, I'm Greg Moralia.
All right, and if you just joined us, this is Living Proof with Diana and Sheridan. And in studio, we have Lynn Keller and Susan Drouse, partners and professional musicians. We are so happy for you both to be joining us right now. We're so happy.
Thank you. So glad to be here.
So we'd like to start out with you just telling us a little bit about yourselves. Like, what do you do for work? What's your passion? What are your hobbies? And Lynn, why don't you start out?
Oh my gosh. Okay. All at once. Let's see. I've been a professional bass player making my living as such for about 43 years. As long as you guys have been together.
What a coincidence. That's great.
I planned it that way.
Oh, okay.
So I started out when I was about 19. It was exciting because I was at the University of Illinois, and there was this wonderful woman who spearheaded the first National Women's Music Festival in Champaign-Urbana, and her name was Kristen Lems. And we became friends. And I was playing keyboard in a band with her, myself and my partner at the time, Cherry Wolfarth, who played drums, and Kristen, and we were called Ms. Conception. And this was, 1974-ish. And Kristen one day said to me, "Hey, do you want to play bass?" And I said, "What is that?" Don't have a clue what it does. Anyways, her boyfriend had a massive collection of them, and he'd bring in a new one every single rehearsal. And just to cut to the end of the story, I never put it down. So, I've been doing it now for a living for most of my adult life, and have had a lot of blessed opportunities to play for a lot of artists, to music direct for a lot of artists, to tour all over the world. So
we would like to know what attracted you to it. Don't run over the story. That's a beautiful part. What connected you to that bass? So,
you know what? I don't really know what it was exactly. There was just something about that frequency. Opposite spectrums. I was a flute major in college, and I would have been a flautist to this day, but I didn't like the professor that I was studying under. He said to me one day, "Well, what do you want to do with your career?" I said, I want to play with the London Philharmonic because Elton John plays with them. And he just looked at me with disdain. He said, well, you have a long way to go. And it was after that that something shifted in me, and I quit school and just kind of stuck with the bass. And Cherry was graduating. She was off to get a master's at an assistantship at the University of Texas at Austin. And she said, why don't you come? Austin's a great music town. And I initially, of course, said absolutely not. And then when her car was packed, ready to go, I'm like, okay, I'm coming up. And so I showed up in Austin, Texas. And Austin, Texas, for the 10 years that I lived there, was an amazing, amazing resource. What I learned while I was there, the styles of music I learned, the people that I worked with. I worked with some of the most phenomenal musicians and vocalists, and not necessarily in the country world like you might think, even though I did do that too. I played with some great jazz musicians and learned that stylistically, and then went back to school 6 years later and finally graduated from the University of Texas. So yeah, it's just, it's one of these things that's just stuck with me, the low vibration, the sound of it, the opposite end of flute.
Yeah, I, you know, as a flutist myself, when I was in college studying, it's more classically oriented, you know, the Handels and the, you know, Vivaldi's, et cetera. So how did you transfer going from flute to keyboard to jazz to all sorts of genres to electric bass? How did you make that shift? Or am I missing something?
No, I don't really think you're missing anything. I'm not certain I can say how I made that shift. I think it was just all contiguous. The flute was classically oriented for me. So I wasn't somebody that was really getting out there and playing Jethro Tull, you know, or Chicago. I mean, yes, I did some of those things upon, you know, when people asked, but it wasn't really my thing necessarily. And really when I started playing bass, in a way I come from almost a classical thought pattern with it. And some of my harmonic lines and things I play just sort of come from that. So it wasn't a huge, like all of a sudden I couldn't relate to my classical life anymore. I still did.
And I'm going to interject also, having worked with her, that she also, a big difference in the way she plays is her touch. And I think that is comes from classical training as well.
Can you say more about that, Susan?
I just have never worked with a bass player whose touch is more like breathing. You know, you always seem to hear the attack of every bass note, no matter what the song is, right? But unless they're playing upright. And she has a way of playing electric that is so smooth and breathes with you. And she, and that's another thing that she does that bass players, I think, often don't. I think because of her training and the flute, we breathe and accompany singers better, you know, because you're just used to long lines and all of the expression. Anyway, sorry, it's my turn.
Yeah, no, that was great.
That's very interesting. Now, Lynn, how someone can hear that in your playing?
Well, I pay.
I mean, you.
Yeah. You...
Oh, that's sweet.
No, she's amazing that way. I mean, I feel like I approach my bass playing maybe different than other bass players. From that context, I put a lot of emotion into my playing, and it's not necessarily about the chops that I have as what I can express when I play. That's the most important thing to me. If I'm really, really saying something. So the fact that she hears that and has noticed that or whatever, nobody ever has said that to me before. So I'm really grateful that, you know, that she hears that and loves that and hires me to do stuff.
That's a good part.
That's a good thing.
Well, she knows how to have, she has to keep the peace. I mean, you know. That's okay. Very interesting though, yeah. To me, about just making the shift to another instrument and still applying what you learned with flute into this other world, 43 years of playing electric bass. I mean, that's pretty amazing. And then we looked on your website. You have your own bass line?
Yes.
So how did that come to be?
There's this amazing luthier named Michael Tobias, and I had approached him for years about making a small instrument for me. And, oh my God, back in the early 90s, he had made one for me, and he called me one day. He said, I got good news and bad news. I said, what's the good news? He goes, the bass is done. I said, what's the bad news? He said, the bridge weighs too much. The bass is too heavy. You're not going to want it at all. So he tried, and we remained friends. And over all the years, I was really looking for a bass that wasn't so heavy, that wasn't so long in scale, but that sounded like it was long in scale. And so in 2004, I contacted Michael again. I said, look, I just got hired to do a tour of Little Shop of Horrors, the first national tour. It's a five string. I don't have a five string bass. Can you make me a bass? And he made me one, which was absolutely beautiful and lovely. And then one day, much to my surprise, this green, almost tie-dye looking green and yellow bass showed up at my door. I was on the road. I was in Houston at the time, and the bass showed up. And it was a 32-inch scale. It was a smaller body, smaller neck, and it sounded amazing. So we fast forward a lot of years, and I think it was 2017. Well, 16 is when he said to me, you know what? We really want you to have your own signature line. And his son, Daniel, works the business with him and will be taking over when Michael officially retires. But they had discussed it, and Daniel said to him, you should do this. You should do this now. We need to put Lynn's line out there. So they created a bass line. It's the Lynn Keller signature bass on MTD. And it is a gorgeous bass. All the basses through MTD are handmade. So it takes a while to get them. It's not a quick turnaround. There's nothing mass manufactured about them. You choose the woods that you want, the colors you want, but generally the electronics have been the same. The size of the neck, the body shape are the same. And so we've been selling the basses. We haven't, because they're handmade, it's not like you sell hundreds of them, but we have done really well. And probably coming up within the next year or so, there may be a lesser expensive version that is more mass produced, so that if people can't afford to have something custom made like that, they can still have a really great sounding medium scale bass. So yeah, that's Michael. And Michael's just a gem. He's in upstate New York. And very, very grateful for him.
Yeah, I just have one more question and then we're going to move on to Susan. But when I see you with your bass on your website, that's lynnkeller.com, by the way, folks, it's got a different design. And I can't help but thinking, is it made for women specifically? Because it kind of bypasses the other breast. So you're not mashing your chest, you know? I mean, it was that part of the...
Well, we never really spoke of it per se in the design, but I did say that I wanted a smaller body, and that was part of the reason. I mean, a smaller body with, you don't want a big horn that's swishing you. It's very uncomfortable and unpleasant, but we didn't take physical measurements of where my breasts, well, they're in a different place now than they were 10 years ago. But,
Bravo! Win for the win.
You know, we didn't take specific measurements, but that is part of it. It's, you know, it's important. You have to have something that's anatomically correct. So his bases work for me really, really well.
Wonderful. Thank you for that. Wow, what a journey. Beautiful. And Susan, you're so patient and so loving.
Oh, I love listening to her and her story.
That's sweet. So, Susan, 4 years old, you were playing the piano.
Yeah.
And tell us more about your journey with music.
My grandmother was a great musician. She was a great keyboardist. She played concert piano. She also played, she would, in during the Depression, she was the woman to be playing the piano in the window of Benjamin Franklin, the Five and Dime, so that people could hear sheet music and then buy it if they liked it. And then she started writing shows, and she supported her whole family with music. You know, being a woman during the Depression, that's, it's pretty amazing. She has her own albums, Best Violet Ledford and her Merry Strings. And every Sunday I'd be at her house, and we would sit at the piano and I would turn pages for her. And I think, I'm quite certain I learned how to read music just because I started to get it, you know, with the patterns. And she started bringing me on gigs because her band would play at square dances. And so I would go on these gigs when I was like four, and I would turn pages for her for the show at night. It was so fun. And when I took lessons myself, I just hated it. It was, you know, Dolly Dinkle's little school for, you know, ugh. And you had to do the recital with the silly little songs. And I just wasn't into it. Fortunately, I was very blessed to have gone to this school in Calumet City, Illinois, Hoover School. And when we were in kindergarten, our the music director for the whole elementary school and junior high came, and he brought his trumpet, and he was a ventriloquist. And his trumpet, Lucky, would talk to you and tell you what instrument he thought you should play. So everybody in our school was in band, everybody. So we had a beginners, intermediate, and symphonic band. And I was, you know, and he taught us individually. He gave us private lessons, every single kid. And he was truly the music man. I mean, he had that black hair like Leonard Bernstein. He would conduct and he would swear, he would yell, he would scare the crap out of you, and you loved it, you know? And he taught us about dynamics and expression. And I would, by the time I was in third grade, I was in the symphonic band and I was playing Shostakovich's Fifth Symphony and things like that.
How old were you?
I was in third grade.
I'm like dumbfounded. Shostakovich is hard when you're in college. I mean,
I know. No, it's absolutely true. I mean, I've played Lynn, and we've had recordings. We have albums. And it was just, he was great because we would learn classical music, obviously. And we obviously learned how to read very well. But then we would march, and we would also put on these pop shows. And then he would take like a, like if you had a band arrangement of, say, The Music Man. You know, there's that little medley thing the band does. Well, he would say, okay, when you get to letter B, we're going to go back to letter A. Clarinets, I want you to stand up and sing, oh, the Wells Fargo Wagon. And he had all this choreography, and we would sing, and there'd be props, and there'd be bubbles. And I mean, it was, so he really, he just expected you to be magnificent. And we were great. We were invited to every World's Fair. I traveled more before I was in high school than I did till I got on the road later. But it was just, I was so lucky. And I was a clarinet, I played the clarinet, and I loved it. And I just was trained in all styles. And then when I got into sixth grade, these boys came to me and they said, we have a rock band and we're looking for a keyboard player. And you have a keyboard? It's like, yes, no, but yes. And I ran home and asked my mom and dad, could I please have an organ? So they got me this mini compact Farfisa organ, and the bottom octave where the keys are normally white would be gray, and where they're normally black would be white. And those were bass notes. And if you put your hand on all the gray notes and turned up the volume, and it sounded like a motorcycle. So we would start the whole show with Born to be Wild, and I'd be like, room, room. But I'm telling you what, that changed me big time, because I loved pop music. I loved it. And then when I went into high school, then Carole King happened, you know, Tapestry, and it just changed my life. And I thought, you know, I stayed with the clarinet. I always thought I'd be a band director, but I went the pop direction, and I thought being a singer-songwriter was just awesome.
Well, you said you wanted to be in the information I found about you on the internet. It said, when most people were deciding what instruments to play in kindergarten, you always knew you wanted to be a conductor.
Oh, yeah.
In kindergarten?
You know what? I wanted to be Mr. Landis.
What?
I wanted to be Mr. Landis, the band director. I wanted to be him. I thought what he pulled out of everybody, and when he would say, like, I still remember this kid's name because he got yelled at so much, Perry Demopoulos. He played the timpani. And he was so short, the timpani was like up to his nose. And Mr. Landis would take that baton and say, I said, break the head on that thing. And next time we started that song, he would jump in the air and boom. And he said, that's dynamics. Wow. And it would just give you goosebumps and chills. And he was awesome. I wanted to be him.
I love your enthusiasm, Susan. Oh my God, it's beautiful.
It's, you know, I really, like I said, I was very, very lucky. And then after that, just things just kept, one thing just kind of, all of a sudden, another opportunity came up. It just kept coming and changing me. And I did the band thing. I didn't go to college. And I thought, well, when I find a school that teaches me what I want to learn, then I'll go. And so I did the band thing for a long time. And then I learned about someone hired me to do arranging. And that's when I knew that's what I do. So I went to school finally in LA for arranging.
What did they ask you to arrange before you decided, okay, this is what I want to do? What was it that they had you do?
Manhattan Transfer arrangement. And I was like, oh, okay. And I learned like, oh, it's much easier if I've just, instead of going vertically, if I just listen to the soprano line and I put that all down and then I listen to the bottom line and then I just fill in the chords because I knew chords really well, then I realized, oh, I love how they did that. And that, and so I started transcribing really more and more things and then started arranging my own stuff. But it was like a just, I think what it is, it's combining all of my background plus Mr. Landis, you know what I mean? And the clarinet and the classical and the pop and all of it. And it's I love it. I love arranging.
Wow, it's beautiful. Hmm. You mentioned something about the boys came to you and asked you. So of course that's gonna bring my consciousness to boys and girls. And both of you are in quote unquote non-traditional worlds for women. I don't see many women playing electric bass. I don't see many women conductors. It's more now than it was when, you know, all of us were growing up. But so how did, I mean, for the boys to come to you, Susan, and ask you, what was all that about? Why would they come to you versus one of their other boyfriends?
I don't think boys played piano, you know, not the cool ones, right? And I think they wanted a girl who could sing to cover some of the other songs that we did. And one of the guys was in band and they knew that I was really good in band and they knew that I played piano. But, you know, so, man, I scrambled like crazy to learn chords because I thought, what is this? But luckily for me, this is back in 1964, 65. All the chords were, you know, all the songs were 3-chord songs anyway, so it was okay. I learned them in every key. Yeah. I could play everything.
And Susan, I'm curious, did you do anything with singing? I mean, you're so talented.
I used to sing a lot, but, got older. You know what else? During the music direction stuff, as soon as I started being the music director for Book of Mormon and working with all those guys, I became a tenor too. So I've lost all my range and it's just gone down, down, down.
And what about you, Lynn, as far as being a woman playing electric bass in when you started 43 years ago with bass? I mean, were there other women that played electric bass and what were your obstacles?
Well, there were a couple in the women's music world. There were a few. Joy Jilks, my friend Diane Lindsay, Carrie Barton, trying to remember who else was around during that time. The ones that had achieved a lot of notoriety, the one is Carol Kay, and she's a friend of mine. Not a close friend, but somebody that has been a champion for me over the years. She's in her mid-80s, I believe. She still plays, but I mean, she played bass for pretty much a million TV shows in the 60s, whether it was Hawaii Five-0 or Mannix or whatever, and then all the Beach Boys stuff and tons of the Motown stuff. I mean, if you spend time with Carol, she's got her ledgers where it's got the session and the date and what song she played on. And she's amazing. She's an amazing, great bass player. So she was a role model to me. But and really throughout my life, there weren't many women doing what I ended up doing, which was touring with all the major leagues and being brought in because I was a really good reader and I had a good feel. And stylistically, I did everything from A to Z. So I was playing with the original Fifth Dimension, and then I was off doing a Broadway show. There's more women now, but I'm not sure how many women are super versatile. There was a period of years where you saw a lot of women bass players in the grunge arena or the hard rock arena. And
in the 80s too, 80s pop.
Right.
Well, what's the grunge arena? What do you mean by that?
Meaning that they're playing with grunge bands or there's a specific style that band is doing and they're touring. And that's what they do. It's like, I don't know that they could venture out from that style. Another great bass player, Gail Ann Dorsey, who's been around forever. She was with David Bowie for years till his passing. She's a wonderful player. I mean, there's wonderful players out there. It's just at the time when I was starting, I didn't really know any women that were doing what I was doing.
This has been so... That's so many questions.
So wonderful to talk to you both. We do have to take a music break right now, and you brought a song, and I'd love for you to introduce it.
Well, one of my favorite people is somebody that I music direct for. It's Jackie D. Shannon. And Jackie D. Shannon wrote Put a Little Love in Your Heart. And if you don't know the song, you need to know it. But it's an amazing song. She also has written a lot of other things like Betty Davis Eyes and But Put a Little Love in Your Heart is her biggest hit. And she wrote a song called When You Walk in the Room. And I really love it. She did an earlier version of it. There's an earlier version. And this version is something she did more recently. She did a pared down sort of acoustic CD of some of her material that she had done previously. And I just think this song is so sweet and so heartfelt. It's how I feel about my girl here on my right. Not that anybody can see she's on my right. however, it's a great song. It's called When You Walk in the Room.
I can feel a new expression on my face. I can feel a glowing sensation taking place. I can hear the guitars playing lovely tunes every time that you walk in the room. I close my eyes for a second, pretend it's me you want. Meanwhile, I try to act so nonchalant. I feel a summer's night with a magic moon. Every time that you walk in the room, baby, it's a dream come true. To stand right alongside of you. Wish I could show you how much I care, but I only finally have the nerve to stay. I can feel something pounding in my brain. Anytime that someone speaks your name, trumpets sound, I hear thunder boom. Every time that you walk in the room, every time that you walk in the room, when every time, every time.
Before we return to Living Proof, we want to remind the listeners that this is our pledge drive. We'd love for you to donate if you love our programming, LGBTQ programming. If you love Outbeat Radio, why don't you give us some of your hard-earned money? We'd love it. We need it. Just simply go to KRCB in your search engine. It will ask if you want to donate to TV or radio. Once you click radio, it will take you to our donate page, and you will see gifts that are there for your choosing. Thank you so much for supporting KRCB and Outbeat Radio, specifically Living Proof.
And welcome back. If you just joined us, this is Living Proof with Lynn Keller and Susan Drouse, and they've been talking to us about their lives as professional musicians. And now we're going to get into more of their own personal stories with being together as a couple. And
as a couple, we love the couple talk, as you can relate. as you know, that we've been together for 43 years, so this is really important topic. So we want to know the journey, how you both met, how you got together, who approached whom first, you know, all of that detail stuff. And maybe, I don't know, you might have different stories. So we want to hear both sides.
Wow. So you want to hear the dirt is what you're saying.
Yes, there you go. We're going to start there. Susan, why don't you start? Ha ha ha.
Uh-oh. All right. I had just been on the road with Billy Elliot for 2 years. Very, very tough show to do. You know, lots of kids, lots of a huge, huge company, a very tough show to play and all that. And it was intense, and I needed to do something different, something really light and fun. And my friend said, you should check out Sister Act. And so I really pushed to get the gig, and I got in there. And my friend Beth Malone said, oh, I bet Lynn Keller's playing bass. She's great. And so I was assuming she was going to be there, you know, and it was exciting that there was going to be another woman in the pit. And I had just been through a really hard breakup. And also, within the first week of rehearsal in New York for Sister Act, before the band starts, it was just, you know, me and music director and the cast doing vocals and stuff. And then that first week, my mom passed away. And it was just awful, you know, in every way. I mean, I was trying to tackle something that, you know, that I really wanted, and I didn't know everybody really well yet, and I felt so alone. I flew back, packed up all her stuff. I'm an only child, so it was just me and taking care of that. And when I flew back, I flew to Chattanooga, and that's where we were going to tech the show. And that is when I first met all the band. So I was in the basement, and I was very nervous. I was playing all my parts, and in she walked. And I just, you know, everything I'd heard about her in my mind, she was going to be this beast, right? And she's 5 feet tall. And I was like, wow, that's the beast. And she came in and, you know, she's hi and sat down, and I was a nervous wreck. She looked so calm and in control. I was making wrong patch changes and playing wrong stuff. She didn't miss a lick. And I just thought, oh my gosh, I got to catch up to her. And it was really I got to catch up where she is. And that's my memory of how we first met. And I think, again, being the only two women in the pit, we gravitated toward each other, and we also sat by each other in the pit. And we started having, you know, lunch and all of that. And just, I just bent her ear with my sad stories. And she was the best listener, and she was there for me. Mm. And changed things for me.
Oh, beautiful. Thank you for that.
Is that what you remember?
No.
Okay, Lynn, give us your part now. Give us your story.
Well, my story, this was 2012. I had been asked to come to New York to play a show I'd played for the premiere of it in LA, but it was going to be opening on Broadway. So they said, we really want you in New York to play this show. So I had my reluctant moment of, oh God, can I possibly live in New York? And so I went to New York and went through hell trying to find an apartment there and started playing Leap of Faith on Broadway. And the show closed in 6 weeks. So I went, I called my mother. I said, do you mind if I come home and have a midlife crisis? And she said, come home. So I went to Niles, Illinois for a month and got myself together. I flew back to New York to play Leap of Faith, the cast album. And then I proceeded to go back to having a pity party about what am I doing with my life? I'd been single for 9 years and not particularly happy about it. And I get this call from the music director that had brought me in for Leap of Faith. And he said, look, Sister Act is going on tour. You know, I don't know, the show Leap of Faith is over. So do you want to, I think you should do this. I think it'd be really good for you. And of course I loved the music. So I said, okay, I'll do it. I'll go out on tour. So I went out on tour, and there I was. Actually, what was so interesting about this is that the music director sent me a text telling me who the keyboard player was and that her mother had passed away. And I felt horrible for her to begin with, but also the name. I knew her name because my very first tour back in the early 70s was with my dear friend Sue Fink. And Sue Fink went to the Dick Grove School of Music with Susan. And I remember when I did an LP, not a CD, but an LP for Sue Fink, that her friend Sue Drouse was going to come in and do some vocal arrangements and stuff. And she always said, oh, Susan Drouse, she's a musical genius. And I remember that in the back of my head. And so here I am now in Chattanooga, Tennessee. And this woman walks in the room and I'm like, that's what she looks like. She's really cute. And I was just really taken with her, but I also knew that she was going through a broken heart about her mother and some other things in her life. And I instantly felt like, oh my God, I really want to be there. I want to help. I want to let her know that she's not alone. And that was really, really important to me. And that's kind of where it all happened. So we both, you know, have an affinity for Chattanooga, Tennessee for that reason. But yeah, so we got involved on the road and playing a show that we both were very emotional about the music for it. We both were in love with that music. It was real special to both of us. So
how many years? Is that 8 years? 2012? Yeah. 8 years.
It was 8 years in October. Yep.
Oh, October.
Congratulations.
Congratulations. Nice story.
That's a beautiful story. Really? Wow. So sometimes when people hear about a sadness of another person, Lynn, they just want to run away. Oh, I can't get involved with that. You know, what made you be the angel that obviously you are? I mean, is that just how you are in your life, or was Susan special, or?
Both. Oh. She is special. And I really felt badly for her losing her mom. And I felt badly for her breakup. And I just, there were issues on the gig that were challenging, and I knew they were going to be challenging maybe before I got into it. Mm. And they were, and I just wanted to be there to let her know how great she was. What a fantastic musician. And try to be, you know, a cheerleader for her. I just felt it. I don't know that I'm that way about everything and everyone, but
yes, you are.
I don't know. Yes. But I was for you.
You're a great listener and a great caretaker, and she has a huge heart.
Mm. Well, you do too. That's what I was drawn to. Mm-hmm. I mean, she's just amazing in terms of the people that, I mean, every day she'll say, oh my God, so-and-so, so-and-so, I love them so much. And I'm like, who are they? Oh, well, I did blah, blah, blah with them. Oh, okay. And I mean, I have a pretty large roster of people that I've played gigs with over all these years that I love. Oh no. Hers is like twice as big. And I, you know, every day it's somebody new. And she'll tear up and I'm like, what? Who is it? Oh, it's so-and-so. Like, who's that? Again. It's true.
That's wonderful. I mean, you two hearts, two loving hearts coming together. I mean, it's beautiful. You know, it's meant to be. It's one of those things. That's what it feels like, you know? Wonderful. Excellent.
And we're getting to play together as well now. Still, mm-hmm. even with COVID, we did a gig in October.
We had three concerts
outside. And mm-hmm. yeah, so that's been, it's really great. Mm-hmm. You know, because we were used to play, that's how we knew each other, was playing 8 shows a week, wow. you know, and not being, and not living in houses. We had our hotel rooms and stuff, you know, so it wasn't really real life. And we weren't sure how we were going to do when we all of a sudden live in our places and we're not on the same gig. She lives in LA. I'm here in Denver and we're figuring it out.
We're figuring it out. Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Nothing like a pandemic to help.
Well, I'm taking it as positive. So yeah, you're working it out. So speaking of COVID, you 8 shows a week. So you're not doing much of that now. So
nothing. I was doing, let's see, March. She was coming to visit me in March. It was March 8th, I think, was my last gig. I did 3 weeks at the Dolby Theater. I was playing Jimmy Buffett's Escape to Margaritaville. And she wanted to come see the last show. And I remember we were on the phone and she's like, oh my God, there's all this going on. I don't know if I should be on a plane. I'm like, honey, don't come and blah, blah. And she decided to come and she came to see the last show and flew back to Denver. And then literally everything was on lockdown. And we've done a couple gigs, just, it was so lucky that it worked out. But we basically have completely stopped working, and there's musical theater has died on the vine at this point. There's no way it can happen. whether it's a tour or on Broadway, it just...
Or regional.
Theater
has taken a huge hit.
Mm-hmm. And music in general, of course.
Yes.
All music has taken a huge hit. Mm-hmm. I got a call to back a group called the Boy Band Project here in Denver at Parker Arts Center. And that was actually really cool. Four vocalists from New York doing their thing. They played two tracks and three band members, and we were all spaced out on the stage wearing masks. Mm. And the audience was socially distanced. There were supposed to be two shows and one was canceled. So I did that. And then we had a wonderful opportunity. A really good friend of ours, a musician, dancer, director, actress, she's wonderful, had access to this outdoor space. And we were all sitting, she owns a restaurant here in Denver, one of our favorite places, and we were having lunch. And she said, you know, I have this space, can we do something? And then all of a sudden it was like, well, let's do the music. Susan has written a show. Do you want to talk about Reunion? You should talk about it.
Well, I knew that I couldn't keep going on the road forever. It was just too tiring for me, too much. And I was really getting tired of people making a buttload of money on shows like Menopause, the musical, you know, which were just like changing words to pop songs and blah, blah, blah. And it was funny. Not putting down Menopause, the musical, but I'd been writing like serious stuff or trying to, and it wasn't getting anywhere. So I thought, I'm going to write something that's more fluffy, but maybe has some really good musical content. And again, I love pop music. So it's a whole series of shows called Reunion. The first one I wrote was Reunion 85. And you go in and you get a name tag. You get a false identity. And it's your high school reunion. And we all graduated in 85. And it's you go into a banquet room. It's not a theater. And there's, you know, bars and there's all the music. And there's two hosts that work the crowd. And there's a band, killer band, that plays all these songs from 85. And it's a journey through the high school reunion. And when you get in, when you first come in, you get your picture taken. And by the end of the show, when they show the yearbook on the screens, everybody in the audience has been photoshopped into the yearbook. And then we have a class photo on the dance floor, and then the band goes right into the dance music and they dance for half an hour straight. It's a really fun party. And I get to really, you know, arrange the music that I love so much. Then the second one was Reunion 69, totally different vibe, made it a college reunion so that we could get into the protesting and everything. Which so it's stuff. Heavy, much heavier, but so moving, you know. And then there'll be two more coming up. One will be a family reunion that I'm very excited about. So you could end up being, you know, Aunt Gertrude, or you could be given a walker, or you could be...
Oh, I would love to be Auntie Gertrude. Yes, give me my walker. I'll be there soon.
Exactly. Anyway, that was, you know, that's reunion. But what we did do for this concert was we did the music from all of these people that performed in this show had done Reunion 85 here in Denver. Mm-hmm. So what we did was we just did the music from Reunion 85 and Reunion 69 with no show to it, no slides, no nothing. But the music is, you know, it was so fun. Wow.
And people danced, people went nuts with their masks on, and people were out there screaming, and it was really, really fun. We did two evening shows and one afternoon show.
Yeah.
We did a tech show, a tech rehearsal the night before we opened in 45 degrees. Talk about trying to play outdoors in Denver in October, trying to seize that moment, which we did.
We did.
And it was really, really fun and unexpected and hard with all of our friends that can't work. We felt really grateful that we had this opportunity with people that we have heartfelt connections with.
Yep.
So it was really great.
Mm, how fun. How fun to be.
Reunion 85 is going to be coming up to your neck of the woods. Where? Actually.
Oh, right.
It's a Transcendence Theater Company is going to, you know, be helping us present that and produce it. And it was supposed to be last April. Then they said it'd be this April. Now we're, you know, we're still waiting to see when it'll happen. But that's the show that's the one they're going to do first. So.
And you're going to be
well. Oh, and so Susan also arranges for the Transcendence Theater Company. So we were up there. She's been up there several times. The last one we did was an amazing holiday show. That was this last November, December. And they're going to be airing it.
Oh, yeah.
Soon.
I should know the dates. Oops.
Yeah. Don't know the dates, but we can certainly email those to you when we check. But they show highlights from different years of different shows, and I'm really proud of what you did for the holiday show, and I'm really proud that I got to play in it.
Oh, nice.
So, yeah, so we'll be going to Transcendence to do Reunion, which is very exciting.
Wonderful. So this time alone, time together, I should say, not on the road, you get to be creative and keep writing and... So, exactly. Susan, you're writing. Lynn, are you writing? Are you doing anything?
I do write. I wrote a new tune that I'm just about done with it, and I will send it off to a friend to mix it.
Oh.
I've been trying to get back to more writing. I've been doing a fair amount of recording bass tracks for Ner Shalom Synagogue and also for some other people. So I have an interface that... thank God I bought that early this year. I thought I may never use this, and it's been the handiest thing. Mm-hmm. So I've been recording a fair amount of bass tracks, and that's been really good for me. So
Ner Shalom, the last name Keller, is there a relationship?
I heard there's a rabbi there I might be related to, but I don't know.
Yes, we all love our Reb Irwin, soon to be Rabbi Irwin.
Rabbi.
Oh, Rabbi.
I'm so excited about it. Yeah. My little brother. I'm very proud of him.
Oh, you guys, this has been the most wonderful interview. Yes. Thank you so much. We do need to end. And so we always ask our guests for words of wisdom. So each of you were like, what would you like our listeners to know about life, about anything you've learned about life? What would you like to share? Lynn, could you go first?
Yeah, well, it's a tough one, really, but it's actually simple. Just come from love. When you come from love, you'll be doing the right things for yourself and for those around you. Just come from love.
Thank you, Lynn.
For me, I was going to say follow your heart and trust your gut. You know, anytime that my soul and spirit and heart have felt like I'm going to make this move, no matter how crazy or no matter what it is the right move. Mm. And I love that.
Mm. Those are some words of wisdom, honey.
Great words. You hear it. We had,
No wonder you two are together. You're so compatible. Yeah. Wow. This has been fantastic. Thank you so much for your time.
Mm-hmm. Thanks so much for asking us. Yes. We so appreciate it.
Wow. Yes. We want everyone to remember, like Lynn and Susan, you too can be living proof that through sharing your craft, your passion, your creative expression, you can make our world a better world. This is Diana and Sheridan, and we'll be back in 2021. Goodbye, 2020.
Yay!
Until then,
good night.
I step out of the ordinary. I can feel my soul ascending. I'm on my way. Can't stop me now. And you can. Never too late to try. What have you done today to make you feel?
We are Radio 91 KRCB-FM Windsor and K215-CQ Santa Rosa, a service of Northern California Public Media. It's 9 p.m. Stay with us. Afropop is next